Okay, would someone read for me Matthew chapter 5, beginning at verse 38, going down through verse 42. Matthew 5, 38 to 42. Just turn it off. That's the best way to do it. Debbie, would you mind doing it?
You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away.
Okay. This is a passage which is troublesome. It's one that is a radical statement that some individuals will say requires total pacifism on the part of a Christian. That is, that they do not have the right to self-defense, either of themselves or their family, that any kind of efforts that are made to protect oneself in the face of physical violence is something that is unacceptable based upon Jesus' words in this particular text. I will say right up front, I don't believe that. I don't believe that's what the passage is teaching, but I do have an understanding as to why some individuals might would feel that way and would certainly respect their conscience in the matter. I think that an explanation of the history of that phrase, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, will be helpful to us. So I want to kind of set the groundwork by establishing a couple of points and then open it up for any discussion as to how literally or how extensive perhaps the context can be applied with regard to our interaction with individuals who are antagonistic toward us. So let's start off by noting the phrase, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. If you have a Bible that has Old Testament quotations in italics, you may note that that is a reference to a number of Old Testament passages. There are two that I would like to read to you. The first one is found in Exodus chapter 21, if you'd like to turn there. Exodus chapter 21 and verse 22, going down through verse 25, having reference to an argument between men, a physical altercation between men, that in some way causes physical injury to a woman who is pregnant. So there, that's a very specific circumstance that is under consideration here. But that phrase is used. So he says, if men fight and hurt a woman with child, so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So there is one example. Now, in this text, my understanding of this, in the phrase the harm follows, indicates that it has reference to the harm to the child. And so if there is an impact with regard to the child's life in this circumstance, then the eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life is under consideration. But, I mean, that's a side issue, but I just want you to note that this is a civil decree. This is the law as stated, and that there will be this penalty imposed by the governing authorities for the individual who has been guilty of this. If you will, now go to Leviticus 24. We've got just one other example. There are several times which it's noted. This is the other one that I want to read. And chapter 24 and verses 19 and 20. Leviticus 24, verses 19 and 20, which says that if a man causes disfigurement of his neighbor, as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Again, notice this is the penalty, that the civil penalty for the injury that was done. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, as he has caused disfigurement of a man, so it shall be done to him. Now, we might consider that to be a rather austere law. It's one that is actually still practiced in some areas of the world. But the idea is, let's say I punch a guy in the mouth and knocks my tooth out, then his punishment I get my own, his tooth out, then his punishment I get my own tooth knocked out. I fracture his cheekbone, then in punishment I get my cheekbone fractured. That's kind of a disturbing concept, I suppose, but it's one that does indicate that there is a legitimate response to where an injury should, or the recompense for injury should be an equivalent pain or equivalent punishment. It's actually something that we follow civilly in our own laws to one extent or another, which is why the death penalty, for example, is reserved only for those who have taken a life. And if there is an aggravated circumstance which leads to a person taking the life, whether it be with regard to the circumstances around it, whether it's premeditated, all those things, that sometimes the civil government will determine that the just punishment for the taking of the life is the taking of a life. And so the death penalty is something that at least now is still considered constitutional and is practiced in some states. So we may refer to this as a law of retribution. The point I want to make in this is that the law of retribution as it's given, and that phrase as it is used, was always intended as retribution for the purpose of civil justice. That is, it was something that would be involving the magistrates. It is a penalty that is imposed based upon an injury that has occurred. And there is no indication in the usage of that language in the Old Testament that it was intended for personal vengeance. So we're talking about retribution for crimes committed, the penalty meaning the crime, in other words, but never as a means of personal vengeance. And we find a principle that Jesus is establishing with regard to his own kingdom, with regard to that idea of giving as good as I get or getting back to someone who has harmed me. The idea of personal vengeance is something that is unacceptable. And I'll give you a passage that notes that. Romans chapter 12, if you'll turn there, and then I'll let you talk, Justin. Romans 12, beginning in verse 19. So here's a principle that is found under the New Covenant, something I think is intended by Jesus in this particular text, certainly. And that is, in Romans chapter 12, in verse 19, the statement by the Apostle Paul, "Beloved, do not avenge yourselves." Do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. And by the way, the wrath that's under consideration here is not merely anger, but the idea of anger which leads to an incitement or a response. So he says, give place to wrath. "For it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And therefore," having reference to your enemy, the one who is harming you, the one who has done something where there is an idea in your mind that I need to avenge myself or take vengeance on that individual. He says, if your enemy is hungry, what you do is feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink, for in doing so you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I think an understanding of this passage, that the significant concept is found there in verse 21 of that passage. Do not be overcome by evil, but as Christians we are always to seek to overcome evil with good. So I think that should kind of center our understanding of this particular text as we look at applications and ramifications of what Jesus has to say there. Justin?
Two things. One, well, eye for an eye applies to capital punishment for murder. You said that that's the only thing that people can get put to death for, and that's not true.
Well, I don't know if I said that, but I didn't intend it. Just the idea that we still practice that to one extent or another in our society.
Right. And then this is really another case where Jesus isn't changing the rule. People weren't allowed to just go stab someone in the eye because they got stabbed in the eye back in the Old Testament either. And the passage that I found was Proverbs 24:29, where it says, "Say not, as he did to me, so I do to him. I render to each according to his work." So, specifically calling promises that vengeance is God's, or that he will repay evil or something like that. And then he obviously, in the passage that you read, is specifically telling the government as his actor.
Right. And I think the same principle is, it continues in the New Covenant very clearly in Romans 13 with regard to the purpose of the civil magistrates and their power to execute judgment upon the ungodly, upon those who are disobedient to the laws of the land. So that principle continues in that regard. Dick, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, first of all, on your handout, let's give a concise explanation of chapter 5, 38, and 44. Are we going to do it concise as we did on NPR?
No, more concise.
Anyway, I've had heard it explained also that goes along with that by Simon Mike Green, is that it says that, where it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and as we read in the other Old Testament passages. And this is to show that if you knock somebody's tooth out, it's only limited to taking his tooth. You go take his eye. Or if you call somebody to lose their hand, you don't take their life.
You're talking about the principle with regard to the civil government, that God would not approve of going beyond that?
Well, that's...
I definitely would agree with that. Yeah.
Make the punishment fit the crime.
Well, right, so that helps the one that committed the crime, but also the victim gets this portion of that.
Okay, Dick had mentioned that as a part of that question is saying give a concise explanation. You'll notice, and I'm not sure, I forget why I put that in there, but you'll notice I put verses 43 and 44 as a part of this section. Maybe the reason why is because within the context of this calling for a response to evil with good, there is involved in that the idea of loving your enemy. As you love your neighbor, hate your enemy. I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. So there is that involvement. I think the basic motivation, don't want to go too far before we get into 43 through 48, but the basic motivation here that the Christian should have always in his interaction with his fellow man is that of love. And that's the primary response that we should give. Now, having said that, there are two things that come, and I don't really want to get into a long discussion on this, but I think it's something we need to at least address partially, is that there are individuals who are, again, as we said, complete pacifists. And what they mean by that is that a Christian cannot or should not only defend himself against physical violence, but also that based upon the principles that are found in verses 38 through 42, that a Christian should not participate in civil warfare. That is, a Christian shouldn't be a soldier. And there are a number of Christians that feel that way. Two that come immediately to my mind. One is Alexander Campbell, and another is Bob Owen. And the reason I know Bob Owen, because he preached a lesson on fellowship, and he used that as an example, that he differed with his brother, who was an individual who actually served in the military, and he considered himself a conscientious objector. He could not conscientiously participate in the military based upon this particular principle. So that's why I will say that I have respect for individuals who hold those views. Now, in response to that, I just have basically one thing I want to say, and then I'll open it up for anyone who wants to add to or discuss this any further. In my own personal point of view in regard to how I react to provocation and evil and such, I'm not interested, never have been. One of the things that I've been able to do, I think, as a grown-up, even as a child or young person, when you're a teenager and the testosterone is starting to surge and everything, you don't have quite those self-control. Never got in a fight when I was in school, never wanted to fight anyone, never got angry enough at a person where I wanted to do them harm. And I still feel that way. And so I'm willing to back down. I'm willing to mollify an individual. I'm willing to take some verbal abuse and maybe even some shoves and maybe even a slap on the face, and I'm not going to respond. I don't have animosity toward those individuals, and I'm not going to get angry and say, I'm going to give you yours. It's just not the way I'm built, number one. I know that some men, it'd be hard not to because of it's the way they're made up. But the idea of okay, someone angers me, and because of anger, I want to hurt that person who's hurt me. I don't think that can be justified in any way by a child of God. Doesn't matter how bad the provocation is, the idea that because someone did something to me, I want to hurt them. That's inappropriate. That violates the concept of love. That's indefensible. And if at any point in time I lose my temper and feel that way or react in that way, then I need to ask forgiveness to both God and man with regard to what I've done. So, having said that, if an individual in my home comes and seeks to harm me or my family, take my life, hurt me, I don't want to hurt them in return, but I am willing to incapacitate them or do whatever necessary to protect my family. Not holding animosity towards that individual, it's simply a mean of a physical preservation. And I think the same thing, I mean, there are a number of instances that I can come across, even in civil warfare, where those kinds of things were done. Individuals fighting for a good cause, but as soon as an armistice or peace, even if it were a temporary one, is there, there's no animosity on the part of those who are doing the bidding of their government for the other side. And it was in the World War I, there was a peace. They were in trenches and they were trying to kill each other. And then all of a sudden, a white flag came up on both sides, and they visited with each other, and they drank together, and they had a meal together, and all of that kind of thing, just as a temporary stop to the. There wasn't anything personal, in other words, in regard to it. I talked with Harry Osborne, a preacher up in Oklahoma City, and he talked about the fact that he could not conscientiously serve in the military. But the interesting thing was this. He's saying, I'm not saying that it's wrong for others to do it, but I could not be in that circumstance and not have that hatefulness and that anger and that vitriol towards the other side or the individual who's seeking me harm. I could not handle that. That's a temptation that I could not handle, and so I would do the very best I could to avoid it. I thought that was kind of an interesting perspective that he had on, and certainly I think instructive with regard to the proper attitude that we have for Christians. So I do not believe that self-defense or even participation in the military is something that is precluded by these words. However, having said that, the concept of personal vengeance or responding in a evil way or a hurtful way to someone who has hurt you, I do not believe that as being an appropriate response for a child of God, and certainly would be spoken, it would be opposed by the text of this passage. So that's the view that I hold in that regard.
One thing that we should notice, other than God's extending authority to civil governments to do this on his behalf, he has reserved for himself the right to execute vengeance. And if we seek to do that, we are usurping his right, which he has not given us to do. So that's one thing we really have to keep in mind. We cannot do that. We have to let that wait until the end time, and he will avenge us of any wrongs that we suffered in this life. There's an interesting fact that I thought maybe you would bring up. In Luke 22:36, when Jesus is about to send the disciples out, or he's talking to them about going out again. Limited commission, he said, don't take purse or anything with you. Depend on the people you go to supply your every need. But this time he says, now take purse, take this.
Take a sword, yeah.
And why would Jesus tell them to take a sword? Only two possible reasons. I really wouldn't think he would tell them to take a sword if he didn't intend them to use the thing. Unless it was to display it as a deterrent only. If you see someone walking down the road with a sword on his side, chances are you're going to leave that guy alone. You don't know if he's going to use it or not.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, he says, I think it's Peter says, we've got two. And he says, that's enough. Well, why not? Why shouldn't we all have swords? He said, two's enough. And more than likely, you're not going to be displaying it anyway. If you're an apostle, you're going to have it in your gunny sack.
Yeah.
And it's there if you need it. But the fact that he said it, he's not going to tell them to buy something and then tell them not to use it. That just doesn't really make any sense. I'm a pacifist. I tried to go. I joined the Navy. And I was going to be a naval flight officer. You know, you cannot go through that training without them teaching you to hate your enemy. You can't go through that training, especially if you're a Marine. But what you go through to learn to kill is totally opposite or ambivalent to the whole idea of being a Christian. My conscience wouldn't let me do it. When I started talking about, you know, bombing babies, you know, and killing babies from the airplane and stuff, I thought, this is really not for me. I think I need to stay away from this. But then I went back later on when it comes to self-defense. I thought, why should I let someone who would kill my daughter live when my daughter has a right to make sure that she is spiritually okay with God? Now, I can decide for myself. I might know for myself. I should know for myself whether I'm ready to go or not. So I can lay down my life. But those that I might defend, I don't know what their spiritual state is. And if I let someone take their life, then they may not be ready to go. And that's something that kind of swayed me a little bit. I still don't own a gun. Yeah. But it's changed my
thing. You know, it's an interesting thing that, and this is extra biblical, but it kind of illustrates the point, I think, is that there, you know, I've done a lot of research in regard to this, and as far as the concept of self-defense as it involves carrying a gun and whether it be concealed carry or defending yourself. And what is taught typically in these classes and such about that is a very simple process, is that you shoot to nullify the threat. And so the point is that you, if someone is threatening you, your life is in danger, you fear for your life or that of your family, you shoot to stop that. You don't shoot to kill. You shoot to nullify the threat. Now, that doesn't mean you shoot them in the leg instead of mid-body. You shoot them mid-body because that's the biggest target, because that's most likely the way the threats could be nullified. But once the threat's nullified, you stop shooting. Now, having said that, so the idea is not to kill, it's to protect. The you go to chat rooms and everything where you've got guys, you know, and then they're saying, I'm going to empty every bullet I've got into their dead body. You know, so that's the kind of concept that a lot of people have, and almost a glee in taking a human life and a desire to make someone pay who dares to threaten me. So that's a worldly idea, and you hear an awful lot about that. There's a lot of testosterone in those kinds of conversations. But the ones who are doing the instructing are saying that's not what it's all about. It's basically to nullify threat. And so, you know, that again, that's a view that we're going to. You know, you mentioned that with regard to that, and I would agree with you entirely that the military is a very difficult thing for a faithful Christian to come out of and maintain his faithfulness. We've got men who have served in the military in this congregation who have done just that, but it's a difficult thing. And most of them will tell you it was a difficult thing. It's not the kind of place that a Christian will have an easy time with because of how many conflicts there are. But I'll leave it up to the conscience of each individual as to how they will conduct themselves in that regard. I just do not believe, in my thinking, that verses 38 through 42 would preclude self-defense. Is that it?
In addition to what Dennis was saying about Luke 22, we often see in the Bible, you know, speak where it speaks, silence where it's silenced. We see nothing being said against the involvement of being in the military. There are many opportunities that God had through Christ and the apostles to address that.
Oh, yeah.
But we never see that. Therefore, you know, if someone is silent, we can see that, yes, there is the ability to serve if conscience allows. On the flip side, this is also where Romans 14 can actually be truly applied. This is not a matter that is purely doctrinal. We can have opinions about this. But this is also, that means that we can say, yes, I'm a pacifist, or yes, I will be willing to kill someone in self-defense or on behalf of the military. But I can't bind my opinions on everyone else, because that's not, there's nothing that says you have to be this or you have to be that.
Okay. I agree with you on that, as far as the respect and the conscience of others. Did we address the point that you're wanting, or is that farther on?
Oh, yeah, that did. I just thinking about it. I only had two fights in my life, and both time I was sucker punched. But I went crazy.
Okay.
You know, and I thought after that, you know, I'd taken pictures, and I'd gotten a new shirt Christmas, and that's about the only time I got new clothes for Christmas. And then a basketball, and I don't know why, this guy was a senior and I was a freshman, and I reached down to pick up the basketball. It was raining, and we were in the gym playing, and he all hit me in the mouth with his class ring and ripped my leg. I looked down, blood going all down my new clothes. And like I said, I lost it. I never did hit him. But I did throw him down on the deal, and I got on top of him with my knees and got him by the hair of the head. And I was going to hit him.
But, yeah, well, see, that's the kind of provocation that we're talking about. I mean, there's a difference in self-defense. You got the upper hand. Does it come to a stop, or do you pummel him? Some of you guys don't know any of you well enough to say whether you're one of them, but some of you, except for him, because he just told me. Some of you guys, you get hit, you're going to respond. Okay, now I'll just give you another example. Now, Josh was fairly young when this happened, but Josh got in a fight just one time in his life that I'm aware of. He's a lot like me in this regard. And what happened was the kid came at him and hit him, and he started backing up. And the guy was taking swings at him, and he was dodging until finally things broke up. And I asked him, I said, why didn't you hit him back? And it wasn't because he was afraid. The kid wasn't actually as big as he was. He said, because we were told by the teachers not to fight, and I was afraid I'd get in trouble. So he's afraid he's going to get in trouble if he swung back. But the idea that he got hit and didn't cause him to lose it, and you hit me, I'm going after you. I'm saying it's a difficult thing that some women, I'm sure, have that same problem. I don't know if any women in the congregation have had gotten fights, but when women fight, it's ugly sometimes. So that kind of thing can happen as well. But the question is, again, is what's in your mind? If that's a problem that you've got, then that's, you know, losing your temper and seeking to harm someone is something you have to, I don't know if you can say you can work at it. I think as you grow stronger and more mature as a Christian, it is. Yeah.
The guy who pulled me off was an ex-wrestler. He put a half Nelson on me, and I calmed down, and, you know. Well, we both got expelled. And I don't know why they expelled me, but anyway, I got expelled, and we were both walking home, and I'd gone get him.
I think I can say that's wrong.
When I met the guy, he walked up and said, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And I said, well, when did you hit me? He said, well, these other guys have been picking me on me for 4 years. And I just decided I said, well, why did you pick on me? I never did. He was a senior. I never even associated with him. And I thought, why did you choose me? You know, and then, well, you know, we walked home together, and that was the end of, you know, the end of it. Didn't fix my shirt that was ruined, but anyway, you know, like I said, a thing. But I thought, now, I guess that's the first time in my life I just really ever got out of control. And I don't know what I would have done if they hadn't pulled me off. And I'm really glad they did. But, you know, I just thought somebody sucker punch you and hit you and rip your lips open and ruin your shirt.
you were very much provoked. Yeah, and again, that's a typical reaction. It's just one that as Christians we need to
strive. You know, and I guess, like I said, is when I got control, you know, and a deal, like I said, and you know, I get out and play sports and everything, and you hit, and you
knock one another around, and but you do it playing. And I said, the only other time I ever got did, the guy, I was running the ball, and he hit me. He came up and hit me in the throat with his elbow instead of trying to tackle me. Well, when I got up and came to, well, it just so happened I was blocking for the punt return. He was going down the sideline, and he didn't see me. Well, I would have hit him anyway if that hadn't happened. I wiped him out.
That's just the
I would have wiped him out anyway, but I just thought,
yeah, you're right.
Vengeance is mine.
That kind of thinking was typical of a 17-year-old, but it's probably not what we should have as Christians.
You don't know.
Dick? Yeah, but there's many reasons why Christians think they can't serve in the military, but this is not, this modern day military is not World War I or World War II. The chances are you could even be in a position to kill anybody, you know. I mean, they got all the computers and everything. Of course, some of them.
Yeah, but there's still a lot of infantry.
Right, but I mean, there's many things that you can do in the military that you don't have to be on the front. There's no front line anymore like that, you know.
No, I understand what you're saying.
But you mentioned about Alexander Campbell. I understand he was also political. I understand he went to Jeffrey Davis and asked to exempt the members of the church, you know. That's what I've heard. Because he didn't want Southern Christians killing Northern Christians,
yeah.
You know, like that. But he, of course, Jeffrey, he didn't pay attention and ended up as a... Anyway, I won't worry about all that.
No, he definitely was a pacifist. Let's enlarge this to get to the end of the chapter and look at verses 43 through 48, because I think the underlying principle is established clearly here, and that is the statement, you have heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Kind of an interesting thing. I mentioned how that the text is in italics when it's referring to Old Testament. So we've got one partially italics and partially not. You shall love your neighbor is an Old Testament principle, but hate your enemy is something that was supplied by tradition, the idea that it's all right to hate your enemy, in effect. And his response to that is, no, I say to you, love your enemies, and bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. So it's basically a continuation of the concept we saw in verses 38 through 42. And notice the reason for this. He says that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet your brethren only, what do you more than others do? Not even the tax collectors do so. Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. And so in this particular context, again, we've got the foundational principle for these ideas as to how we should react. And that is that concept of loving your enemy and keeping in mind this idea of not responding to evil with evil, but rather responding to evil with good, overcoming evil with good. And that is an indication that a person is loving. Now, we've made mention of this time and time again, so we don't have to go in great detail. The word love in this context is agape love, which is an action word. It's often translated in the King James Version as charity. So you see, being charitable to others, or to have charity, that means to do things that are good for others. And now the word charity is kind of a limited word and doesn't fully encompass the concept of agape, but it does help us to understand that it has reference to how we conduct ourselves toward individuals. So if I've got hatred and vitriol in my heart toward my enemy, I am not going to desire to do good, nor will I engage in good activities on his behalf. It's just not going to happen. There's got to be a motivation to respond to those who do evil to me in an opposite way, one that is characteristic of the Heavenly Father. And that's what we're called to. This concept of love is so important because this is the way that God acts. And we are to act as God acts. God is love. We are to be, characteristically in our lives, loving individuals. That means seeking the welfare of others. So when someone misuses us,
Let's just look at those couplets in verse 44. The one who is our enemy, indicating he hates us, we're to love him. The one who curses us, we are to bless him. The one who hates you, you're to do good to. The one who spitefully uses you and persecutes you, you are to pray for. That's the proper response of the child of God. And so that's the idea that I want to get out of verses 38 through 48. The idea that this is the way the Lord acts. This is what God says is important. And for us to be disciples of His and be perfect as He is, indicating a spiritually mature, a whole, a complete person, the type of person that God would have you to be, then your reaction to evil must be good, not evil in return, whether it be vengeance or anything that would be considered a hateful or injurious or destructive thing. Instead, we are to love and to seek blessings and to pray for and to seek to help in any way we can those who are our enemies.
Stand the cut, verse 40.
Uh-huh.
That's verse 40 was that anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Whosoever compelled you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him that asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn him away. That's what I want. That's what I'd like. I want you to.
Well, okay. So here is someone who's wanting to take away your tunic. So just think of that in that proper thing. Okay, we're going to go to court, and I'm going to countersue. You know, that kind of thing. That's an attitude that you can take. Say, you want my coat? Well, here, you can have my coat, and you can have this as well. It's a material possession. That's my response. It is an appeasement. It's a way of mollifying. It's a way of overcoming, maybe getting them to think in their minds that, hey, I'm acting inappropriately. And by the way, it's very effective. That often happens. I was talking to a woman just on Facebook. She had said some questions about fellowship. And she talked about a friend of hers. She was the responsible for converting this lady. And the lady had become unfaithful and had been withdrawn from. And so they had she had asked to meet with her. And so they got together. And she did two things. She said she did not smile a bit through the entirety of the conversation, like a 2-hour time. All they talked about was the lady's spiritual needs and such. You know, in other words, she wanted to kind of touch base again, but she said, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to talk about your unfaithfulness, and I'm calling upon you to repent. And said that after that, she had to leave, and she was hungry. And the lady gave her a sandwich and left the room. She said, no, I'm not going to eat with you. I cannot in good conscience do that because you've been withdrawn from. And so she wouldn't even sit down and eat with her. And it was only a few weeks after that the woman repented and came back to the Lord. And she said the reason why is because I saw how much you loved me, how much you cared for me, and how serious a thing that this was. And it brought her to her senses. And I thought that was an amazing story that she told. But that woman was expressing love. It was an individual that there was a conflict that existed. She was only interested in what was best for that lady. And she, as difficult as it was for her, she did what was best for her and brought her to repentance as a result of it. So in looking at these kinds of things, you know, someone is, you know, let's say David's a soldier. He's making you go with him a mile. You know, most people just, what do you mean? I don't want to. Yes, you have to, you know, and they could require it. And so you're required to go along with them. So in response, a Christian could say, here's your spear. And because I think the part of this was that the soldier could compel someone to carry with them and travel with them and carry a load to assist them. That was something by law they could do. I said, no, I'm not going to just go a mile. I'm willing to help you more than that. I'm going to go 2 miles. And again, the response to someone who is acting toward you in a negative way is a positive thing, can turn them and turn their attitude, and it's a positive expression that shows love. So that's the kind of idea that's found here. Help who you can help is the point. Yes.
this is just something extra I wanted to share. Jesus said, anyone who wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. If the most valuable thing you own is a tunic, and someone sues you for it, you're not going to fight for a piece of clothing. The most valuable thing that Jesus owned was a tunic. John tells us because it was all one piece, the soldiers wouldn't tear it. It was valuable. That's why they cast lots for it. He didn't have any other possessions. That was it. When you have so much and you want to hold on to it, that's what you want to fight for. And maybe there's a lesson there in that verse when Jesus says tunic and cloak instead of something more valuable. That's what he's talking about.
Well, it's definitely a value that typically we struggle with in our day and time because we are somewhat married to our possessions.
Yeah.
We are so blessed that there is that tendency on our part to become. I wouldn't like the rich young ruler. He went away sorrowful because he had many possessions. The idea of sacrificing basically our very shirt on our back for the Lord is something that we struggle to comprehend.
Okay.
But that's just an indication of the problems of having those kinds of tithes. And we need to be careful about that.
I wanted to add one thing, which we're all aware of. The scripture says pride goeth before a fall. And what he's talking about there, I think, is not, you know, it covers a lot of different sins. Pride is involved in a lot of sins. And it's involved in what we're talking about here, the idea of retaliation. Once you get past the threat on your life, now it's pride.
Yeah.
And that's what Jerry was talking about. His pride was affronted. And it hurt his pride. When you're humble, you got a meek and humble spirit, and you have no pride to struggle with. Someone slaps you, you're not going to slap them back. You're not affronted by what people do to you. It makes life a lot easier.
It does, and it's a when you see in the phrase there, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's a high standard that is very difficult to attain. Difficult to reach.
You ever ask about the borrow part that Jerry asked?
Do what?
About borrowing. You going to be able to answer that?
I didn't need to end the question.
But yes, about that.
Yes, I will answer that. Now I understand this. If we look at every clause of every verse, we're never going to get finished. But yes, I will make point. Well, what's not understandable about that, though? Give to him who asks you. If you can help someone who has need of help, then help them. Is that what it means?
Yeah.
That's what I thought it meant.
Standard reason, one thing about, you know, I worked as an insurance adjuster, and of course I worked on defense. Now, insurance policy is bought by a person. One reason they bought it is because it's the law, but another reason is for protection. Mm-hmm. Okay, when one of our policyholders had a wreck, then I was assigned the case, and I was to handle it. My goal was to defend our policyholder. Well, I run into some religious people. I'm going to quote these verses here about the son, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And when I wouldn't pay them what they thought they deal, you know, well, they just start quoting these scriptures to me, but I'm like, well, wait a minute. I'm representing the insurance company.
Yeah,
I've got a contract to protect this person.
A little bit different.
That does not apply to me.
Listen, everybody, for the first time, I don't have to say Matthew 5 next week. Matthew 6 next week. Matthew 6.